Thanks for having me.
So maybe we could just start with my asking, what's the most difficult issue that you've tackled in the last couple of years as a journalist?
You mean in the era of Trump?
That's exactly right.
Yes, there are a lot of difficult issues. And as I listened to you give that introduction, I thought a lot of the kind of news industry questions are happily above my pay grade since I'm a lowly content provider. But I think that covering Trump has been a huge challenge for a couple different reasons. One of them is that it's hard to tell my listeners the difference between the merely outrageous and the truly consequential. Sometimes they're one and the same thing. Because, of course, he, in his mind, in Trump's mind, sometimes being outrageous is how he stays consequential, or at least that's what he thinks. So that means, should the media go chasing down the rabbit hole of every single tweet, or should we pay attention to the policies that are happening or not happening? So that's one thing. The other thing is that Donald Trump is a stress test on democratic institutions, and the free press is first and foremost among those. And not only has he called us enemy of the people and fake news, he even went so far recently to say that fact checkers are fake news. I thought that was taking it to a whole new level. But there's also just the aura of menace at his rallies. We recently saw a BBC cameraman roughed up. There's the chilling signs that I saw, at least during the campaign, maybe not recently, or a T-shirt that said "Rope Tree Journalist, Some Assembly Required." So a lot of those stresses on the press preceded Trump. I think he has exacerbated them. So you have to be fair. At the same time, you're being constantly attacked, and you try not to get distracted by things that are merely outrageous and not truly consequential.
Have you covered some of his rallies, either during the campaign or since?
Yes, I
And
have.
what's it like to be there in the middle of it? We watch it, but what's it like
Well,
to
first of
actually
all, you're
sit?
in a pen, which usually in the past, there was more opportunity at any political rally to walk among the people who are there, so you could interview them, but that's very difficult at a Trump rally. And of course, we are his favorite foil, and the crowd is sometimes even more anti-press than he seems. You know, there's the CNN sucks chant. There was when I only saw the footage of this. I wasn't there on the border on Monday night, but when the CNN, I'm sorry, when the BBC cameraman was accosted by a guy wearing a MAGA hat and he was restrained by I think, a security person, that the crowd started chanting, "Let him go, let him go," as if they were saying he should continue beating up the BBC cameraman. So, it's menacing, but the rallies are just one piece of covering Trump.
And how the other part I've noticed, and I don't know how new this is, it seems that the pace of the media has accelerated, that the focus on any particular issue moves very quickly. I mean, like day to day almost, the entire news cycle will shift what it's concerned about. Is that perception accurate? Is something going on, or is that just being in the thick of it?
Well, I think that's being in the thick of it, and I think it's a choice. If you spend your life on Twitter, spend your life watching 24-hour cable news, you will feel that. And yes, the president's metric for success is dominating news coverage. He wants the Trump show to be on the air and dominating the media narrative 24/7. And for the most part, he's succeeded in that. But that is something different than what is actually happening, policies that are actually being enacted, things that are going on around the world. So I do think it's a choice to, if you, it seems overwhelming. I feel overwhelmed all the time, but I think that's a choice. For instance, you can look at the actual record of the Trump administration, what he's passed, what he hasn't passed, and compare that to literally the amount of coverage every single tweet and utterance gets. Part of this is the business model of cable and the business model of the internet and the business model of social media. But one thing that I do think is interesting that's changed since January is the Trump show now has a co-star or a co-producer, you could say. We have been reminded that there are two co-equal branches of government, And Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic House is now sharing the stage with him. And it's kind of it's a whole new season.
And how do you as a journalist go about, back to your earlier point, deciding what you're going to cover, how you're going to discern the noise, as they call it, from the stories that most matter to you or have more consequential of an impact?
Right. Well, I think that I do that in concert with my editors, obviously. I mean, the Washington desk at NPR, where I work, has to decide that every day. Some people have to cover everything that happens during the day because we're a news organization and we have news shows. And others of us, and we rotate this, are free to do more analytic pieces, to take a look at to step back a little bit. And I think that's the job of any big mainstream news organization, is to try to do both of those things at one time. Tell people what happened today, but then also try to explain what it means.
And is it possible, is it hard to cover policy? I heard Ezra Klein talking, the founder of Vox, and that one of the things he wanted to do with his site was bring policy journalism into the business and have a space to cover non-personality-based stories. Do you find that that's difficult, possible at NPR and in your daily
life? I think it's possible at NPR. NPR puts a premium on that.
Yeah.
Yes, it's possible. I think the other big challenge is to get people to pay attention because, for instance, you know, the debate over the border, that's kind of a classic example. There's the noise. There's the constant talk from Trump about invading hordes and caravans and criminals. There used to be terrorists, but he's dropped that. Now it's just women with duct tape around their mouths. But then there is the absolute fact, which should drive policy, that illegal border crossings are at their lowest level since 2000. And I think by some metrics, they're at their lowest level in 40 years, which I think is a really essential fact that gets lost and that I almost think should be in every single story that we do about the border debate. Because one of the other challenges that we're facing as journalists today is that we don't start with a shared set of facts and then work our way to opinions. People generally now start with an opinion and backfill the facts that help them. You know, it's one thing to say, to acknowledge, yes, illegal border crossings are at their lowest since 2000, but even one is too much and that's a crisis in our eyes. Fine. You know, that's a legitimate argument to make. But you can't say that, for instance, when he went down and said that crime in El Paso went down after the wall, that's just not true. So I think fact-based journalism, policy-based journalism, whatever you want to call it, it's a struggle. But I believe that in the last 2 years, many, many news organizations are doing their absolute level best to do that.
And was your first presidential election that you covered, was it 92? Was it Clinton?
Yeah, I covered Bill Clinton. And back then, if you covered the winning candidate, a lot of times you got to go to the White House and become the White House correspondent, which is exactly what I did. It's a tradition. It's not a hard and fast rule. But I covered Bill Clinton in the 92 election, and then I covered his administration, all 8 years of it.
Do you remember it being very different?
Oh, there's no comparison. First of all, you covered it in person. You followed the candidate. You couldn't just watch everything on video. You'd go out on Monday and come back on Friday. At least that's what we did at NPR. And then somebody else did the weekend duty on the bus. So that's really changed. We had much more interactions with the candidate and the staff. And this isn't something that Trump just invented. I think over time, as presidents have more tools at their disposal to bypass the media or the press as a filter, they don't need to rely on us to get their message out. They have other ways to do it. Social media, et cetera.
Was there any your memories of the relationships of the pool covering the campaign? Did the relationships among reporters change from 92 through the years you've covered?
Oh, among reporters? No.
Yeah.
I think there's always been camaraderie. The big difference, of course, is now we have a partisan press environment where we have left-wing press and right-wing press. But that is something that you could blame the fairness doctrine for. But no, I think there's always been camaraderie among the press. I mean, you know, you spend a lot of time in a in a metal tube flying around the world. And I don't think that the press is hostile to each other.
And which of the campaigns that you've covered most stands out to you?
Bill Clinton, because it was my first presidential and it was the most fun.
Uh-huh.
It was wild and woolly, but there was guy who had tremendous personal scandals, and we always had to decide whether we wanted to just do the Clinton scandals. But he also was somebody who was deeply invested in policy, and so there was plenty there, too.
What was it like to cover the 2000 election?
The 2000 election I covered intermittently because my daughter was born in August of 2000. Uh-huh. But I did cover then I came back in October because the election never ended. That was really something. And if you want to look at hinge points in our history, the Supreme Court, Bush v. Gore, was definitely a turning point. But that was more or less a traditional campaign, I think, a normal campaign. After 8 years of a president, people generally want to change. Al Gore was struggling to figure out what he could do, how much he needed to cleave to Clinton, how much he had to separate himself from Clinton and the Clinton scandals. But I would consider that a kind of normal, old-fashioned campaign.
Did you have mentors who taught you how to do this? How did you learn? You start with a big presidential campaign.
No, I didn't start with it. Well, I had already worked at NPR and I was covering Congress, and I was working under Cokie Roberts, who at that point was our chief congressional correspondent, so I definitely learned from her.
Uh-huh.
I had a lot of female mentors because NPR back then had Cokie Roberts, Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, Susan Stamberg. We used to call them the founding mothers of NPR, or sometimes the Fallopian Club. But they were incredible, and they really advocated younger women journalists, and I would not be where I am without them. So they were my mentors, specifically Cokie. I worked with her on Capitol Hill. And I can't really remember how I got assigned to Clinton, but I did. And, so I went from – I started as a newscaster. Then I was a general assignment reporter. Then I covered Congress. And then I was assigned to Bill Clinton, covered the campaign, and then I went to the White House with him.
Before we get back to today, were there any moments in any of these elections that you covered – or as White House correspondent, that were learning experiences, meaning something happened that you really saw a different way to do journalism or a way to improve what you were doing? Any stories stand out?
That's a really, really good question, and I'm trying to think about that. There are a lot of moments that stick out, but in terms of something that showed me how to do journalism differently, I think sometimes, especially for radio, learning how to take a small moment and then pull back to have it illustrate a bigger story or a bigger issue, I think was something that I had to learn how to do. Finding the moment on the campaign trail that kind of illustrated something bigger that I wanted to explain to my listeners. I'm not thinking a specific story isn't coming to mind. Of course, the one big moment from the Clinton years, which is having its 20th anniversary, and there's all sorts of documentaries out there now, of course, is the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And I happened to have an interview with Bill Clinton on the day that story broke in the Washington Post.
Wow.
So I was probably one of the first, I think there was one guy, maybe Mort Kondracki had an interview right before me, but I was probably the second journalist who actually asked Bill Clinton if he had a relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And there's your moment about scandal versus policy, because he was giving three interviews that day in the run-up to the State of the Union address, which was very traditional. Presidents used to give a couple interviews before the State of the Union to preview what they were going to talk about. And I had a tiny little scoop about what he was going to say about Social Security. Back then, the whole debate about privatizing Social Security was starting. And that was going to be my policy focus for the interview. And then we woke up in the morning. Robert Siegel, who was the host of All Things Considered, and I, who were doing the interview together, read the paper and went, oh, gross. We have to ask him about this. And we did.
What was his reaction?
His reaction was, I don't know anything more about this than you do, Mara. And then he went on to say, you know, there was nothing inappropriate and he had to go back to work for the American people, et cetera, et cetera. But that was before we knew anything other than he was being accused of having an affair with an intern and lying about it in a deposition.
You think looking back, the media handled that scandal well? Because there's some critics of it, obviously.
Yeah. I think, you know what? I really think that the media as a whole, it's not one monolithic thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, tremendous mistakes were made, as the famous phrase. But I think the media didn't know quite what to do. They didn't understand what it was at first, and it became the first real partisan scandal, I think, of the modern era for journalism. I mean, you could say the same kind of thing. Maybe the media's obsessive media, I hate to use it as one, as if we're one thing, but maybe certain media organizations' obsessive focus on Hillary's emails was in some sense because they felt they hadn't been tough enough on Bill Clinton with Monica Lewinsky? Unclear. But these are very difficult decisions, and there's a herd mentality always. And you can't ignore it, but you have to cover it, and you have to cover it fairly. And then there's the question of how much time or inches you give to a certain story. It's a really, really, these are really hard decisions.
It must be a perpetual concern for any reporter in terms of being played, essentially. That you become one of the weapons in a polarized Washington.
Oh, that is hugely dangerous. And people lie to you even when they're off the record.
Yeah.
So that's really difficult. Look, classic example, this Green New Deal. NPR was one of the first news organizations that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's office gave the resolution language, gave the frequently asked questions, the fact sheet, and then called us afterwards to ask us if we would please take it down off our website because there were, you know, either mistakes in it or it was causing a lot of controversy, and we didn't correctly.
And what was your impression? Another issue that has happened that I want to bring up, the whole BuzzFeed story. And there was an interview after that, actually, with about Watergate with Woodward, I believe, and how mistakes also were made in the Watergate era. What was your impression with the BuzzFeed story, this weird cryptic, release from Mueller? And obviously, quickly, that became part of the political landscape. Did you read
BuzzFeed,
the whole thing?
Well, the interesting thing about the BuzzFeed story, and it's funny, I'm remembering the controversy, but just refresh me. They had that people who'd seen documents from the special counsel that they had established a direct link, or what was the—
That Michael Cohen had been instructed by President
Trump. That's right, instructed by
President.
And there was some kind of evidence to that. Okay,
right.
Well, here's what I think about that. Nobody else could match that story. What does that tell you? We handled that story with kid gloves. I think if you can't match that story, why is it on cable news 24 hours a day? If CNN can't match that story, why are they talking about it all day? And I think that's a cautionary tale. Be really, really careful. Nobody else could match BuzzFeed, and there are a lot of really good reporters working on that same beat. And the fact that the special counsel, for the very first time, had to actually say something to bat that one down, I think that, BuzzFeed moves fast and sometimes breaks things. You know, as Mark Zuckerberg used to say, but I think that they could have taken a little more time maybe because nobody else could corroborate it. And I know they still stand behind their reporting, but I think in the end, the special counsel actually did themselves a big favor because now that they've batted down a story, it's much harder to say that they're conducting a witch hunt.
And I mean, do you worry after something like that, that it hurts the credibility? And again, we don't even know what was right or what was wrong in
that
story.
Right, we still don't know, right.
But does it hurt? Does it have a bigger effect beyond BuzzFeed? Do those moments concern you?
Sure. Yeah. Every time any news organization makes a mistake, even though it's often immediately corrected, it makes it harder for us to withstand the onslaught of attacks that we're fake news and, you know, we're not telling the truth or being objective. Sure, it makes it harder. But we have a high standard for ourselves, unlike the politicians we cover.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the other thing, if those moments overwhelm everything the journalists are doing right.
Well, I don't know if they overwhelm it, but they undermine it. Yeah.
They undermine it. Yeah. Right. But at least the public discussion will focus on that story.
Yes, which is unfortunate.
A 100 others.
Yes.
That were right on target.
That's right.
Yeah. And when you meet younger journalists today, you must meet a lot of them. Are they different than in terms of their understanding of what it means to be a journalist and how news is produced than when you were, you know, starting your career?
No. I think the standards are the same. Get it right. Check it twice. Talk to as many different people as possible. I really have a lot of admiration for younger journalists because guess what? It's much harder to be a journalist now. You know, I've worked for the same news organization for 33 years. Like, who else can do that now? I was lucky. You know, NPR was kind of marginal when I started and it ended up being a pretty solid institution. But it's really hard. You have to be able to operate on all platforms. Sometimes you're not even a full-time employee. It's hard.
Do you find yourself doing more of that? I mean, figuring out how to translate your stories, not just on the air, but online and
social
media.
Well, like I said, I'm a lowly content provider and my stuff is on all sorts of different platforms. Yeah. I'm on podcasts. I'm in our digital, you know, I write digital stories. And of course, I'm on the radio. So yes, I've had to learn how to adjust my content for different platforms, but it's not that different. I mean, a podcast is radio,
right?
Really. And digital, we have a lot of wonderful digital editors who can help me turn my radio scripts into properly written print stories, digital stories. So we have I have a lot of support for that. But
and so now you're getting ready for 2020.
Oh my goodness! Yes, I'm getting ready for 2020.
How are you doing that?
Wow. Well, I'm just getting a lot of sleep, hoping it will it will last through the year. 2020 is going to be, I think none of us can even imagine what 2020 is going to be like. I think everybody is on the lookout for foreign intervention in social media, but I think that might be yesterday's story. I mean, the tools that the Russians used are available to anybody, as we found in Alabama, where even Democrats use them trying to help Doug Jones get elected. So anybody can send out an army of bots to promote fake stories. We haven't even seen the beginning of deep fakes, which is the thing that I'm the most worried about. You know, bits of audio or video that purport to show a candidate doing something really damaging. And yes, there is a way to determine whether those things are real or not, but maybe not in enough time if they are dropped, you know, 2 days before an election or a primary.
What other concerns do you have? So deep fake news, fake news.
Right.
What other issues are you thinking about as you prepare to cover?
I think also there's just how we cover, what we focus on. In other words, do we focus on likability? Or do we focus on the policy agenda? You know, that to me is an early challenge. There was a lot of controversy about a Politico article that said that Elizabeth Warren might be tripped up by the same problems as Hillary Clinton in terms of likability. And a lot of people thought that was a really sexist take. Other than the fact that they're both female and have blonde hair, I really don't see them as being similar at all. But so those are the things that you have to kind of wrestle. I don't think female journalists have that problem. But, you know, there's going to be a huge, huge field. And this is not a new problem, but how much attention do you give to candidates who seem obscure or seem in a lower tier? You know, that's a constant discussion in the newsroom. I don't think that's new, but that's something that we're all going to have to weigh, and especially because we potentially have a really, really big Democratic field.
Do you ever think, and this has been now not just this coming election, but you have this whole world of data, journalism, the 538 crowd and this Upshot and all these sites that are really focused on arguing big picture analytics, big trends and fundamentals really explain what's happening or what's going to happen more than the day to day, you know, game changer gaffe. Mm-hmm. And then yet you have this whole world that you're part of that that covers politics on the day to day basis. Do you ever think about that, that for some academics, they're always debating, you know, is the daily coverage, the horse race coverage, is it missing really what's going to affect the election? Do you think about that all, or how do you think of the relationship between these two clusters of journalists?
Yeah, I do think about that. And when I think about it, I thank God that I don't work for a 24-hour cable network because that's what drives this. 24 hours is a lot of hours to fill. And if you want to be on social media for 24 hours a day, you want to watch cable 24 hours a day, they have to chew over the game-changing gaffe or the potential game-changing gaffe for 24 hours. And it's crazy. Now, there's a place for both models that you just laid out. Yes, there should be data-driven journalism. You should pay attention to the fundamentals. What did we learn in the 2018 elections? We learned that fundamentals matter. We learned that historical rules haven't stopped working. Of course, the cliche is historical rules only work till they stop working, but they haven't. And that, you know, the economy, the way people feel about the incumbent, all those things really do matter. So I think you got to do both things at the same time. And given that the internet is limitless, there's plenty of room to do both of those things at the same time.
And what do you think?
Unless you work for a 24-hour cable network.
Then you don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
In terms of the big issues that the election will be about, and obviously we don't know exactly yet, but at least from the perspective of now, what do you think they will be? What should reporters at least be doing their research on and preparing to look at as we really get into it in the next few months with the primaries and debates?
Well, I think that there's two debates going on. Obviously, there's the general election debate, which is shaping up because you already have one general election candidate, Donald Trump, who has made it very clear what his theory of the case is, what his message is going to be. It's going to be the Democrats are the party of socialism, open borders, late-term abortion, and crime. That's it. And what he sees as the crisis facing the country are illegal immigrants crossing the southern border. The Democrats have a completely different idea of what is the real crisis. They think people, you know, need to have wages that aren't stagnant, some kind of economic mobility, a government that helps them obtain reasonably priced medical care, college, retirement, and housing. I mean, so in some ways, the two parties are talking about two completely different things. They're not arguing about the same thing. So what will be really interesting to me as a journalist is to see where the public is, you know, whose theory of the case do they find speaks to them and their day-to-day problems. In terms of the Democratic primary, that's going to be a whole other debate. The internal debate, I think, is between someone who is there are a couple of debates. One is, do you want a pugilist or a pragmatist? In other words, do you want to be the left-wing mirror image of Donald Trump, a kind of scorched earth, you know, fighter, or do you want someone who somehow finds a way to argue against the politics of division? I think on the policy front among Democrats, we're really talking about degrees. Everyone wants universal coverage. Some of them want Medicare for all right away. Others will want optional buy into Medicare at age 50. I mean, those are different degrees. I think that the Democrats in polling show that they want someone who can win more than they want someone who agrees with them on every policy. So I think that's going to be one of the big debates inside the Democratic Party. There's going to be an argument about who can win Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and maybe Ohio, if Sherrod Brown is in there. And that's going to be something that we're watching for. I think just, you know, general challenge is just how to cover such a big field.
Final question. So you meet a high schooler who's on their school paper, editor, writer, excited about journalism. They want to get into it, but they worry. They hear there's not a lot of jobs. They hear it's a kind of crazy world right now where everything's up in the air. What's your response to them? And I'll ask for a positive response in terms of why there's just a lot of great things going on right now.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't discourage them. I think my response would be positive. All the things you mentioned are things that are so daunting that I wonder if I was starting out now if I'd have the guts to try it. But given that it's been such a wonderful life for me, I would never dissuade anybody. But I would say, hey, you're young. Go for it. You know what? If it doesn't work out, you can do something different later. And everything that you're going to learn being a journalist is going to help you do something else if it comes to that. But right now, if you are a hustler and an entrepreneur and are willing to, you know, operate on every platform, you can really have a wonderful, wonderful career.
Then let me follow up with one last question, really. Is there a story that you remember over all these years of great, great reporting that you've done that for you is a real moment of pride that you would share with this student that you think about that impacted what you do?
Wow. Boy. You know what? I'd have to go and sit down and like go through the hundreds of stories. I guess the stuff at the beginning of the Trump administration where I really tried to separate the merely outrageous from the truly consequential and I did see him as a stress test on democratic institutions, and I tried to keep an eye on how those institutions were doing, some of them better than others. I guess those stories, there have also been so many stories in the past when NPR basically was able to give us the time, not just on the air, but the time to develop these 8.5-minute stories. They were like mini documentaries. I probably did one a week when I covered Clinton. They were filled with sound, and we went out in the field. And now, because there's so many more demands on us, just to be on so many more platforms, I do a lot less of that. But those were just wonderful times. Any of my campaign stories from the past, I think.
Well, thanks so much, Tamara Liasson of NPR. Thank you for joining us. It's really been a pleasure to hear about your experience and thoughts on journalism. So thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have questions for us to address, please email them to politicspolls@princeton.edu. And thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.